Hello, this is Jackie Cohen, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Monday, December 1st issue of the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Dry summer, Mount Morris repairs. Crews use drought conditions to install guides, review interior materials not accessed in decades. The dry season in 2025 that left much of western New York in drought conditions had one unexpected benefit. It provided an opportunity for some much-needed maintenance and upgrades at the base of Mount Morris Dam. The upstream conduits at its base, which allow the Genesee River to pass through, have been untouched since construction was completed on the dam nearly 70 years ago. The aged infrastructure needs maintenance, and the only way to do that work is through the bulkheads to seal off the river. It's that time where we've got to get back in there and do some more heavy capital maintenance, said Steve Winslow, manager of the Mount Morris Dam. While Mount Morris Dam is considered a dry dam as it doesn't maintain a reservoir, it does hold back water as needed to keep river flow manageable as the Genesee River flows through communities downstream. The guides for the bulkheads were installed during the deep drought this summer. Large dirt berms were constructed to redirect the remaining flow of the Genesee River, while the steel rails were affixed to the surface of the concrete dam. The steel bulkheads with rubber gaskets come as two separate pieces, each 4,000 pounds, which are lifted into place and provide a watertight seal over the conduit they block. The bulkhead installation and fabrication cost about $720,000. Now, when we have a major project inside of one of these tunnelways, we can come down here in the summer when it's a period of dry weather like it is now, install that bulkhead and block that water flow from going off, Winslow said. And we just bought ourselves about however much time we need to work inside of that culvert in a dry situation. While the dirt berms, a cofferdam, were in place for work on the bulkhead guides, it awarded a unique opportunity to look at the conduits. It's the first time inspectors were able to access that part of the dam since its construction, a chance to review the concrete, steel, and gate components critical to the dam's operation. Other parts of the dam are able to be inspected on a routine basis. The good news is a lot of it is in very good shape, better than we anticipated, Winslow said. So that's going to help save some money in the future. Mount Morris Dam is considered a high-hazard dam due to the people and infrastructure downstream, including the city of Rochester. Routine maintenance by the Army Corps of Engineers is happening all the time, but preventative maintenance and more investment will be needed as components of the structure age. The concrete is in good shape. A lot of the interior components are in good shape, but they're older, Winslow said. So, things that were made out of steel and installed in the 50s, we've got corrosion issues. We have some damage from weathering and erosion. The installation of the bulkhead guides was planned for about 5 years, including design and funding allocation. When conditions dried out this summer, it became a perfect opportunity to move ahead on work from July through September. What are the chances we wouldn't have rain during that period? Winslow said. If we had about a 1-inch rainstorm, that would have overtopped our cofferdam, believe it or not, and then that would have interrupted this work and kicked it into the future. Rochester Keg Tree takes top ranking, Rockefeller Center's Evergreen 5th in poll. Step aside, Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. It's time for another Christmas tree to shine, and it's made from empty beer kegs. Yes, sitting atop this year's Newsweek Best Christmas Tree list, like a bright, shining Genesee beer sign, is the Genesee Brewhouse Keg Tree. It was chosen by Newsweek readers from a list of finalists selected by our expert panelists and contributors, the magazine states. All we can say is, well done, readers. The Rockefeller Center tree, a tradition since 1933, and the nation's most famous holiday beacon, according to Newsweek, came in fifth. This despite its 50,000 glowing LED lights and a 900-pound Swarovski crystal star. The entire list reads as follows. Number 1, Genesee Brewery Keg Tree. Number 2, Congress Hall Tree in Cape May, New Jersey. 3, Galleria Dallas Tree in Dallas. 4, Fairmont Scottsdale Princess Tree in Scottsdale, Arizona. 5, Rockefeller Center Tree in New York City. 6, Dallas Arboretum Tree in Dallas. 7, National Christmas Tree in Washington, D.C. It tied with Philadelphia City Hall Tree in Philadelphia. Number 8, Biltmore Estate Tree in Asheville, North Carolina. 9, Faneuil Hall Marketplace Tree in Boston. Runners-up are Capitol Holiday Tree in Madison, Wisconsin, the Grove Tree in Los Angeles, California, Monterey Bay Aquarium Tree in Monterey, California, Newport Mansions Tree in Newport, Rhode Island, Royal Hawaiian Tree in Honolulu. For more, go to newsweek.com. This year's Keg Tree Lighting. This year's free Keg Tree Lighting event starts at 5 p.m. December 5th at the Brew House, 25 Cataract Street, and will continue through 9 p.m. The switch will be flipped on the tree, built from 650 empty beer kegs, and wrapped in 25,000 twinkling lights at 7 p.m. Dean Jones, Brewhouse Brewmaster, will serve as Master of Ceremonies and count down to the lighting, which will be accompanied by popular holiday tunes animated on a lighted board. New this year is Genesee's debut of Keg Tree Donuts, a festive collaboration with another Rochester institution, Donuts Delight. The special treats, honey bun donuts infused with Genesee Brewery's Keg Tree Cinnamon Ale, are available through December 5th at the Brew House and Donuts Delight, 1700 Culver Road. They also will be sold at the Keg Tree Lighting, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the Breast Cancer Coalition. The Keg Tree debuted in 2014 and was an instant hit. The first one was made from 300 empty half-barrel kegs trimmed with 600 feet of LED green rope lights. Capped with a rotating Genesee beer sign, the tree stood 23 feet tall, reaching the second-story brewhouse balcony. Poll: Latinos express deep dissatisfaction with Trump. Findings reveal concerns on economy, deportation. A majority of U.S. Latinos believe their situation has worsened under President Donald Trump, a Pew Research Center poll released on November 24th found, the first such deterioration since the poll began tracking almost 20 years ago. Asked how they see their situation, 68% of Latinos said it has worsened in the past year, while about 80% said Trump administration policies do more harm to Latinos than help them, Pew said, a key reason they view their position as worse. Trump's mass deportation efforts and a sluggish economy have weighed on Latinos, whose votes in the 2026 midterm elections could be critical to maintaining Republican majorities in the House and Senate. There's no doubt that if people draw the connections to a particular administration or political party, this could have some political implications in coming elections, said Mark Lopez, director of Pew's Race and Ethnicity Research. Trump's support among Latino voters was historically strong for a Republican candidate in the 2024 presidential election, aided by their economic concerns and gains among Latino men. Pew surveyed 4,923 Latinos between October 6 and October 16th. The margin of error is 2.6 percentage points. The nonpartisan organization said 1,116 of the Latino respondents were immigrants. About 82% of Latinos are in the United States legally, according to other Pew data. Pew's reports tracked with an October Reuters Ipsos poll that showed 32% of Hispanics approved of Trump's job performance, well below his overall 42% approval rating at the time. About 90% of Latinos responding to the Pew study said the Trump administration is doing too much when it comes to deporting immigrants who are in the United States illegally, up from 56% in early March. But they agreed that some people do need to be deported. In addition, 52% said they worry they or someone close to them might be deported, compared with 42% in the early weeks of Trump's second term. Lopez said while the report showed broad discontent among Latinos, the data was nuanced in ways that may influence voting. The economy ranked as the top issue among Latinos in the 2024 election, and while the cost of living remains high, about half of Latinos surveyed said they expect the situation to improve. 2026 results key for Vance's future. VP seeks to hold Trump coalition ahead of 2028. Vice President J.D. Vance has a lot riding on the November 2026 midterm elections. He is seen as the frontrunner to be the next Republican nominee for the White House, yet he faces the more immediate challenge of being one of his party's leading messengers as the GOP tries to hold its six-seat majority in the House of Representatives. For Republicans to be successful, Vance is warning endangered lawmakers that they need to motivate the working-class voters who helped President Donald Trump take back the White House and don't typically show up in non-presidential elections. That challenge was reflected in Republicans' poor showing in the recent Virginia and New Jersey gubernatorial races, which Democrats won by wider margins than their 2024 presidential victories in those same states. I think that's one of the lessons that we learned in Virginia and New Jersey, is that when Donald Trump is not on the ballot, you've got to give people something to actually believe in, something to be inspired by, to get out there and vote, Vance said during a recent event with the Breitbart News. They're not going to vote just because you have an R next to your name. Republican victories nationwide would be a useful springboard for Vance's expected White House campaign, which he has said he will discuss with Trump after the midterm elections. I think he's right to be worried about next year, said Matt Bennett, a former senior advisor to former Vice President Al Gore and an executive vice president at the center-left think tank Third Way. What we don't know beyond next year, when we get to 2028, is whether that Trump coalition holds together without Trump, and there's evidence that it will not. A collapse of Trump's coalition in 2026 would present a major challenge for Vance, 41, just as he begins to gear up for his anticipated 2028 presidential bid. He's a newer politician who's had less time than his recent predecessors to develop a record on which to run. He'll be heavily reliant on Trump's legislative successes and his involvement in them. The former U.S. Senator for Ohio was in office for 2 years before being elected vice president. He has fashioned himself as someone with the ability to bind old guard Republicans, MAGA, and swing voters together without alienating any one constituency. His ability to do so now and in the future will be tested as he leads the administration's midterm messaging push on domestic policy and acts as the finance chair for the Republican National Committee. Vance has been cautioning Republicans about complacency. He said in an early September interview on Fox News with Lara Trump that a pollster for the president told him that anger often wins midterm elections. That presents a problem for Republicans in 2026, he indicated, because our people aren't angry. The left is very angry right now, and they're very motivated, he said. That motivation gap could be seen in November's elections in Virginia, New Jersey, and California. In New York City, energy on the left was visible in the high turnout mayoral victory of Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Vance faces uphill climb. Since the November election losses, the White House has waged a messaging war aimed at convincing a skeptical public that Trump is doing everything in his power to bring down prices, even rolling back some of his tariffs. He's been weighing an expansion of enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies that were at the center of the government shutdown that ended November 12th. The push has done little to improve voter sentiment about Trump or the economy. Trump's 41% approval rating in a November Fox News survey is the lowest of his second term and below former President Joe Biden's at this same point in his term when it was 44%. More than three quarters of voters view the economy negatively, according to the Fox News poll. Even among Republicans, 42% said Trump was responsible for the current economic conditions, compared with the 53% who blamed Biden, the administration's frequent boogeyman. None of that bodes well for Republicans, whose House majority is in serious jeopardy. Democrats need to win an additional three seats to take control of the chamber, with which they could stymie most of Trump's agenda. Internal fighting divides base. Sensing danger, one of the president's most prominent allies, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, abruptly announced November 21st she will resign from Congress on January 5th after fighting with Trump over his opposition to releasing the government's files on the late disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. She was critical of Trump's policy of issuing visas to foreign workers with certain skill sets and the amount of energy he was putting toward international affairs. The MAGA influencer, who's viewed as a possible challenger to Vance, tied her departure to a potential blowout for Republicans in the midterms. She said they wasted their legislative majority, and when they likely lose the midterms, it will become total and complete political war and gridlock. What is the convincing message for 2026 and likely 2028? She asked in a November 24th social media post. It will be the American people asking candidates, what tangible thing have you done for me, and how did it or will it make my life better? And then actually trying to get them to vote after both parties have failed them. At the Breitbart event, Vance said Republicans should have their debates in podcasts and op-ed pages, but he urged them to focus on the enemy rather than internal divisions. He argued later in his remarks that working-class voters who have joined the coalition don't care what Republican orthodoxy was 25 years ago, and they are pushing the GOP in a different direction. We need to lean into this new coalition, Vance said, do a better job serving them, and that's how we get them to show in these midterm elections, so that we can win. Politicians try to unmask creators of satirical page. A satirical social media account focused on a central California county is at the center of a First Amendment debate over the rights to and limits of anonymous political speech. The controversy stems from a Facebook page called Benito Beat Beat, which was created in June and says it provides a fresh, satirical slice of local politics and news from San Benito County. But the county's Board of Supervisors hasn't taken kindly to the page and voted to approve a subpoena to Meta for records to reveal the creators' identities, court records show. Now, the First Amendment Coalition, a free speech advocacy group, is suing to protect those behind the account and get the subpoena dismissed. The coalition filed the November 26th complaint in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. It said the subpoena followed a since-deleted political cartoon the account posted in early November that referenced potential security cuts at the county's behavioral health clinic. The cartoon depicted an imaginary situation in which a staff member said, "We're in danger, call security now," because a person in mental distress seeking help at the clinic said, "Voices are telling me I need to hurt a supervisor or his kids," while another staff member thought, "We cut security because Supervisor Ignacio Velasquez told us to do it," the complaint said. The board approved the subpoena weeks later based on its belief that the cartoon's depiction is clearly a threat and appears to call upon others to inflict physical harm, the complaint said. But the First Amendment Coalition is arguing that the post, like the rest of the page's content, is political satire, which has some of the greatest First Amendment protection. If plaintiffs' identities are disclosed to the county, they will suffer irreparable harm arising from violation of their First Amendment right to anonymous speech, the complaint said. Once lost, anonymity cannot be regained. The organization also said the investigation inherently chills their First Amendment rights. It went on to claim that the subpoena exceeds the board's authority under California law and therefore violates the Stored Communications Act, a federal privacy law that restricts the government's ability to compel third-party providers to provide users digital communications. The subpoena ordered Meta to produce records by December 2nd, though a judge granted a temporary pause November 26th. Another hearing is scheduled for December 10th. In granting the pause, U.S. Magistrate Judge Virginia K. DeMarchi wrote that the plaintiffs were likely to succeed in arguing that the speech in question is protected under the First Amendment. While the cartoon is hyperbolic and provocative, plaintiffs are likely to succeed in showing that it cannot reasonably be construed as a true threat of violence against any individual or the board collectively, or as an incitement of others to commit violence, DeMarchi wrote. USA Today reached out to the Board of Supervisors and Meta for comment. Experts weigh in on safety of eating snow. It was a frigid winter day as I ran several miles through Brighton with friends. The water from my handheld bottle was long gone, and I was parched. I quickly ventured past the multicolored layers of plowed snow near the curb and scooped a pristine, fresh handful into my mouth. Was it my best call? Probably not, since snow consumption is not recommended while running or in a survival situation. But it worked in a pinch, since it had snowed several inches earlier that day. In heavier or prolonged snow events, later layers tend to be cleaner, making the snow safer to eat. Here's what experts generally recommend for eating snow. When is it safe to eat snow? First thing to know about eating snow, not all snow is created equal. While fresh snow may look appealing, there are several factors to consider to ensure it's safe and clean. As snow falls, it can collect bacteria, microplastics, and pollutants from the atmosphere, such as black carbon from coal-fired plants and wood-burning stoves. Laura Martin, an assistant professor of pediatrics at Ohio State University College of Medicine, previously shared some expert tips with Food and Wine on how to safely enjoy snow, emphasizing the importance of avoiding contaminants and harvesting it properly. Here's what to keep in mind. Harvest safely. Place a clean bowl outdoors in undisturbed areas to collect fresh, fluffy snow. Stick to pure white snow. Avoid gray, brown, muddy, and most importantly, yellow snow. Avoid ground-collected snow. Do not eat snow that is directly on the ground. The safest snow is the top layer, farthest from the ground, and free of dirt, debris, or critter activity. Skip plowed snow. Even if it looks clean, it could carry toxins. Personally, my family makes snow ice cream whenever more than a foot of snow falls in our backyard, but we'll only ever make it the morning after snowfall by scooping the top few inches off the snowpack. And we nix the recipe anytime we see numerous animal tracks near the back patio and house. It's also important to avoid eating snow from public spaces, like parking lots, streets, or sidewalks, as it may contain rock salt or other chemicals used to prevent ice buildup. Also, steer clear of snow near animal feeders, ponds, or other unfiltered water sources, which can introduce contaminants. What about hypothermia? Hypothermia is likely not a problem if you're eating a bowl of snow ice cream or sneaking a few flakes while playing in your yard. But hypothermia can come into play if you're depending on snow as a source of hydration, according to the Cleveland Clinic. Any hydration you're getting from eating or drinking snow isn't as great as the energy you're using to melt it. So over time, if you're consuming a high quantity of snow, in theory, it can dehydrate you, according to Cleveland Clinic physician assistant Max Huddleston. Someone in survival mode in the wilderness may not have another option, he said, but consuming large amounts of snow can decrease your overall body temperature. Sending Christmas gifts from New York in 2025? See delivery deadlines. Holiday shipping deadlines are approaching faster than you may think, as some packages will need to be sent as early as December 15th. You may have to pay more, too, as the USPS announced it's charging more for Priority Mail Express, Priority Mail, USPS Ground Advantage, and Parcel Select during the 2025 peak holiday season. The USPS released the following recommended mailing and shipping dates for expected delivery before December 25th. USPS Ground Advantage Service, December 17th in the contiguous U.S. and December 16th in Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and U.S. territories. First Class Mail, December 17th. Priority Mail, December 18th. Priority Mail Express, December 20th. 2025 UPS holiday shipping deadlines. UPS released the following recommended shipping dates for domestic shipments for expected delivery before December 24th. UPS Ground. Depends on package destination, origin, shipment date, and weight. Check deadlines by visiting ups.com/ctc. UPS 3-Day Select, December 19th. UPS Second Day Air, December 22nd. UPS Next Day Air, December 23rd. 2025 FedEx Holiday Shipping Schedule. FedEx released the following recommended shipping dates for domestic shipments for expected delivery before December 24th. FedEx First Overnight, FedEx Priority Overnight, FedEx Standard Overnight, Extra Hours, December 23rd. FedEx Ground Economy, December 15th. FedEx Ground, depends on how many days it will take for the package to arrive at its destination between December 17th and December 23rd. FedEx Home Delivery, depends on how many days it will take for the package to arrive at its destination between December 17th and December 23rd. FedEx Express Saver, December 20th. FedEx 2-Day and FedEx 2-Day AM, December 22nd. FedEx Same Day, December 24th. What is National Free Shipping Day? National Free Shipping Day started in 2008 and takes place annually in mid-December. Many companies in the past have foregone shipping costs, allowing shippers to keep a little extra money in their pockets in time for the holidays. When is National Free Shipping Day in 2025? This year, Free Shipping Day lands on December 14th. What stores participate in Free Shipping Day? Retailers make the decision whether or not to participate in Free Shipping Day. In the past, these stores have included Amazon, Walmart, Apple, Target, Nordstrom, Barnes & Noble, Bloomingdale's, Best Buy, Kohl's, and many others. Check each store to see if you can earn some additional savings by shipping gifts on December 14th. Popular bar closed after underage drinking bust. The Brockport Police Department says an October enforcement detail uncovered widespread underage drinking violations at Mason's Pub and Pizzeria on Clinton Street, prompting the business to surrender its liquor license and close. According to police, a multi-agency operation in October, conducted with the New York State Liquor Authority and Department of Motor Vehicles, followed months of investigative work into alleged license violations. Officers reported finding 85 patrons under age 21 inside the establishment, many without any form of identification. 35 people were issued a total of 37 citations related to the possession or use of fraudulent IDs. Following the detail, the business voluntarily surrendered its liquor license and has remained closed. State agencies are considering penalties against the owner, police said. The investigation is ongoing and additional charges are possible. No further information will be released at this time, according to Chief Paul G. Wheat. You are listening to an reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Rochester teen arrested in FLCC stalking investigation. A 19-year-old Rochester man was arrested November 25th in connection with a stalking investigation tied to Finger Lakes Community College in the town of Hopewell. According to the Ontario County Sheriff's Office, Sean D. Whitaker, 19, is accused of sending hundreds of threatening and obsessive messages to the victim between July and November 2025. Investigators say he continued contacting the victim even after being expelled from the college. Deputies report that the Whitaker also is accused of creating a fake email address, posing as a college staff member in an attempt to lure the victim back to campus. He is additionally accused of deleting digital evidence relevant to the case. Whitaker was charged with tampering with physical evidence, third-degree stalking, second-degree aggravated harassment, and second-degree criminal impersonation. He was taken to the Ontario County Jail for pre-arraignment detention and is expected to appear in Hopewell Town Court at a later date. Study unveils milestone in history of domestic felines. Whether they are Siamese, Persian, Maine Coon, or domestic short hair, there are hundreds of millions of cats living with people around the world. But despite their popularity as pets, the history of cat domestication has remained difficult for scientists to decipher. A new genome study is providing some insight into the matter by determining the timing of a key milestone in feline domestication, the introduction of domestic cats into Europe from North Africa. Domestic cats pounced into Europe roughly 2,000 years ago in early Imperial Roman times, the researchers found, probably thanks to maritime trade. Some of these furry trailblazers may have been brought by sailors to hunt mice on ships that plied the Mediterranean, carrying grain from the fertile fields of Egypt to ports serving Rome and other cities in the sprawling Roman Empire. The findings contradict a long-held idea that domestication occurred in prehistoric times, perhaps 6,000 to 7,000 years ago, as farmers from the ancient Near East and Middle East first moved into Europe, bringing cats with them. We show that the earliest domestic cat genomes in Europe are found from the Roman imperial period onwards, starting in the 1st century AD, said paleontologist Claudio Ottani of the University of Rome Tor Vergata, lead author of the study published November 27th in the journal Science. The study used genetic data from feline remains from 97 archaeological sites across Europe and the Near East, as well as from present-day cats. The researchers analyzed 225 bones of cats, domestic and wild, ranging from about 10,000 years ago to the 19th century AD, and generated 70 ancient feline genomes. The researchers found that the cat remains from prehistoric sites in Europe belong to wild cats, not early domestic cats. Dogs were the first animal domesticated by people, descended from an ancient wolf population separate from the modern wolves. The domestic cat came later, descended from the African wildcat. The introduction of the domestic cat to Europe is important because it marks a significant moment in their long-term relationship with humans. Cats aren't just another species arriving on a new continent. They're an animal that became deeply integrated into human societies, economies, and even belief systems, said University of Rome Tor Vergata paleontologist and study co-author Marco Di Martino. The genome data identified two introductions of cats to Europe from North Africa. Roughly 2,200 years ago, people brought wild cats from northwestern Africa to the island of Sardinia, whose present-day wildcat population descended from these migrants. But those were not domestic cats. It was a separate dispersal from North Africa about two centuries later that formed the genetic basis of the modern domestic cat in Europe. The study's findings suggest that there was not a single core region of cat domestication, but that several regions and cultures in North Africa played a role, according to zooarchaeologist and study co-author B. de Cooper of the Royal Belgian Institute of Natural Sciences. Global measles cases drop 71% in 24 years. Global measles cases fell 71% to 11 million in the years spanning 2000 to 2024, driven by improved vaccination coverage, the World Health Organization said in a report on November 28th. Measles vaccination has prevented nearly 59 million deaths globally, with the number dropping nearly 88% over the 24-year period to 95,000 annual deaths in 2024, according to the report. Last year did see a resurgence in measles, with estimated cases rising 8% compared with pre-pandemic levels in 2019. Measles-related deaths, however, fell 11% during that period, reflecting a higher number of infections in middle-income countries with a lower fatality ratio, the WHO said. Measles is the world's most contagious virus, and these data show once again how it will exploit any gap in our collective defenses against it, said Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who the WHO's director general. Measles is often the first disease to see a resurgence when there is a drop in vaccination coverage, the agency said, adding that growing outbreaks expose weaknesses in immunization programs and healthcare systems. Even small drops in vaccine coverage can trigger outbreaks, like a fire alarm going off when smoke is detected, said Kate O'Brien, director of the Department of Immunization at the WHO. She warned that similar gaps are almost certainly likely for other vaccine-preventable diseases, such as diphtheria, whooping cough, and polio. In 2024, 59 countries saw large or disruptive measles outbreaks, nearly three times that in 2021, and the highest since the COVID-19 pandemic, the WHO said, adding that there was a resurgence even in high-income countries that had once eliminated it. Canada lost its measles elimination status in November after failing to curb a year-long outbreak. The U.S. and Mexico also reported significant outbreaks this year, with thousands of cases and a few deaths. The WHO warned that deep funding cuts to the Global Measles and Rubella Laboratory Network and country immunization programs could widen immunity gaps and drive further outbreaks in the coming year. The agency scaled back its work and halved its management team after its top donor, the United States, announced its departure in January. Amazon tells customers of holiday shopping scam. While working to school customers on potential scams during the holiday shopping season, Amazon is especially urging shoppers to be vigilant of impersonation scams, in which scammers pretend to be representatives of the online retail giant and steal personal information or money. The company confirmed to USA Today on November 28th that Amazon has been sending customers messages about avoiding such scams. When asked about the notices, Amazon clarified the messages are not warnings or alerts, as other outlets have reported, but educational efforts to protect customers. The company first started sending out the messaging in early November to U.S. customers and customers in the United Kingdom last week. Amazon is estimated to have over 310 million active users worldwide, per AMZ Scout, which uses Chrome and other apps to conduct product research. In October 2021, the Federal Trade Commission reported that one in three customers claimed someone had contacted them, claiming to be Amazon representatives. Some people reported that the scammers begged them for help and said Amazon would fire them if they didn't help them. Among businesses scammers reportedly impersonated, Amazon was at the top at 35%, followed by Apple at 6%. About 96,000 people reported being targeted, and nearly 6,000 said they lost money, the FTC wrote in the report. Christy Vargas of Amazon's public relations team said on November 28th that scammers put Amazon consumers at risk. "We will continue to invest in protecting consumers and educating the public on scam avoidance," Vargas said in an email. Impersonation scams occur when scammers pretend to be trustworthy organizations or people, with the goal being to steal money or personal information. Scammers typically carry these out by calling, emailing, texting, and messaging victims on social media, Amazon said on its website. According to Amazon, some characteristics of impersonation scams include false urgency. Scammers try to create a sense of urgency to get customers to do what they want. Asking for personal information. Scammers may try to get information such as addresses, payment information, account login credentials, or financial information. Purchases outside of Amazon. Scammers often ask victims to send them money outside of the Amazon website or mobile app through a third-party site or wire transfer. Payment via gift cards. Scammers may ask victims to buy gift cards and pay with those, or ask for the gift card numbers, claim codes, or PINs. Unexpected orders. Victims may get notifications of orders or deliveries they did not expect. If customers receive notice of orders they didn't place, they should go to the official Amazon website or app and check their order history. Amazon customers can find information on identifying scams and reporting them in the customer service section of the website. Those without Amazon accounts can report suspicious messages by emailing an attachment of the messages to reportascam@amazon.com. Keg Tree Lighting 2025. Date, parking, and what's new. It's getting to be the time of year for chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, and that most Rochester of holiday traditions, the Genesee Brewhouse Keg Tree Lighting. When is the Genesee Brewhouse Keg Tree Lighting? The party starts at 5 p.m. December 5th at the Brewhouse, 25 Cataract Street, and will continue through 9 p.m. The switch will be flipped on the tree, built from 650 empty beer kegs and wrapped in 25,000 twinkling lights at 7 p.m. Dean Jones, Brewhouse Brewmaster, will serve as Master of Ceremonies and countdown to the lighting, which will be accompanied by popular holiday tunes animated on a lighted board. Where do I park? Attendees are encouraged to use a rideshare service because parking around Genesee Brewery will be extremely limited, and in the past, the Keg Tree Lighting Ceremony has drawn thousands of people. For those who choose to drive, the nearest parking structure is the High Falls Garage, 240 State Street. The best way to travel on foot between the garage and the brew house is the Pont de René pedestrian bridge. Is there an admission fee? No, the event is free. Can I bring my dog? No, pets are not allowed. What's new this year? New this year to the event, Keg Tree Donuts from Donuts Delight. They're being made by the iconic donut shop at 1700 Culver Road using Genesee's Keg Tree Ale, a cinnamon twist on the classic Genesee Cream Ale. Donuts Delight owner Nick Semerero said talk of partnering with the brewhouse on the pastries started casually. One of my managers knows somebody over there and kind of presented the idea, Semerero said. There was no major plan, just casual talk. But it led to a meeting and everything clicked. Donuts Delight had never attempted to make a beer-infused donut, but Brewmaster Jones is kind of the mad scientist of beer and I'm the mad scientist of donuts, Semerero said. A lot of experimentation and hundreds of test donuts later, a winner emerged. Both the dough and the frosting contain Keg Tree Ale, so they only will be sold to people 21 and older. Because the Keg Tree Lighting is a family-friendly event, we're going to have donuts for the kids, Semerero said. So a mom and dad donut and a kid donut. He hasn't settled on a price yet, but a portion of the proceeds will go to the Breast Cancer Coalition of Rochester. Both entities decided that was the most important part, he said. What other food and drinks will be available? Five food trucks will be on site for this year's Keg Tree Lighting. Rob's Kebabs, Rob's El Dente, Wraps on Wheels, Travelin' Tom's Coffee, and Rochester Kettle Corn. Four Genesee beer trucks will dispense, among other brews, the Keg Tree Ale. What about photo ops? Guests will be able to snap photos in an oversized sleigh, handcrafted by Genesee's union carpenters, around festive holiday igloos, and of course, beside the three-story keg tree. Genesee Keg Tree History. The Keg Tree debuted in 2014 and was an instant hit. The first one was made from 300 empty half-barrel kegs, trimmed with 600 feet of LED green rope lights. Capped with a rotating Genesee beer sign, the tree stood 23 feet tall, reaching the second-story brewhouse balcony. It didn't go up in 2020 because of the pandemic. The tree returned in 2021, but without a lighting ceremony. That same year, it got national attention when the website Time Out included the keg tree on a list of 11 weird and wonderful Christmas trees in the U.S. This year, the tree is a finalist in the Newsweek Reader's Choice poll for the best Christmas tree and in USA Today's best public holiday lights display. We're so excited to celebrate one of Rochester's most iconic and now nationally recognized holiday traditions, said Tiffany Bowman, Genesee brand manager. When, how to watch Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting. The 2025 lighting of the 75-foot-tall Rockefeller Center Christmas tree is set for Wednesday, December 3rd. The event is from 7 to 10 p.m. at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in Midtown Manhattan. The Christmas in Rockefeller Center special will air live on NBC at 8 p.m. Eastern U.S. time and stream on both NBC and Peacock, the network's website said. Country music star Reba McEntire, who can be seen on Happy's Place and The Voice, will host and perform on the special. NBC said other performers include musical guests Mark Anthony, Halle Bailey, Michael Bublé, Kristen Chenoweth, Lau Fei, New Edition, Brad Paisley, Carly Pearce, the Radio City Rockettes, and Gwen Stefani. The Rockettes celebrate their 100th anniversary this year, are also slated to perform. And what about the lights? Well, there are more than 50,000 multicolored LED lights on about 5 miles of wire on the tree, Rockefeller Center's website said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Democrat and Chronicle on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The star topping the tree was designed by architect Daniel Libeskind in 2018. It's a three-dimensional Swarovski star that weighs in at about 900 pounds. It has 70 spikes covered in 3 million crystals. The tree, about 75 years old, is 45 feet in diameter and approximately 11 tons, the website said. It's a Norway spruce from East Greenbush in New York's Rensselaer County. A journey of about 130 miles brought the tree to Manhattan after the tree was cut on November 6th. The tree will be on display until mid-January. Rockefeller Christmas tree, a staple since 1933. The idea of a tree at Rockefeller Center dates to 1931, when Rockefeller Center workers pooled their money to buy a Christmas tree, a 20-foot-high balsam fir with handmade garlands made by their families. In 1933, Rockefeller Center decided to make it a yearly tradition and held the first tree lighting ceremony. Other New York City holiday tree lightings. Rockefeller Center's is not the only tree lighting in the Big Apple. The lighting of the 45-foot Bryant Park tree, also in Midtown, is set for the day before, Tuesday, December 2nd, according to the Bryant Park website. Festivities are scheduled to get underway at 5:30 p.m. The event will stream online for free at wintervillage.org. World-class skaters are expected to perform. Olympian and U.S. champion Mariah Bell, U.S. Olympic team members and bronze medalist partners Caitlin Hoayek and Jean-Luc Baker, Canadian national champion Kaya Reuter, and U.S. Olympic team member Emmanuel Savory. Holiday music sing-alongs and fireworks are also on tap. Actor and chef David Burka will host the Bryant Park event. 4 dead, 10 hurt in shooting at child's birthday party. At least 4 were killed and 10 others were wounded in a shooting at a family party in Stockton, California on November 29th, according to local police. Gunfire erupted inside a banquet hall in California's Central Valley, where a family had gathered to celebrate a child's birthday party, the San Joaquin County Sheriff's Office said. Several of the 14 victims, including children and adults, were taken to local hospitals. Four have been confirmed dead. Heather Brent, a spokesperson for the sheriff's office, said early indications suggest the shooting may have been a targeted incident. Police are still searching for the suspect. As of 9 a.m. Eastern Time on November 30th, Brent told USA Today the sheriff's office had limited information about the shooting. Police received reports of gunfire at the banquet hall shortly before 6 p.m. local time on November 29th. The shooting broke out during a child's birthday party, Brent said. It occurred at a shopping mall complex that includes a Dairy Queen, a local donut shop, and an Asian restaurant, among other shops. San Joaquin District Attorney Ron Freitas said at a November 29th news conference, shortly after the incident, that the suspect was still at large. Officials asked anyone with information to contact the sheriff's office. Our number one priority right now is identifying this suspect, Brent said during the press conference. Early indications suggest this may be a targeted incident, Brent said. This is a very active and ongoing investigation. Information remains very limited at this time. Governor Gavin Newsom's office issued a statement on social media hours after the shooting, calling it a horrific incident. The governor said he was monitoring the situation and coordinating with local officials. Stockton is located about 45 minutes south of California state capital, Sacramento. The city has a population of about 320,000, according to the latest Census Bureau data. U.S. Representative Josh Harder, whose district includes Stockton, said he is monitoring the situation and is in close contact with local law enforcement. I'm devastated at news of a mass shooting in Stockton, and Pam and I are praying for the victims and their families, Harder said. Mayor Christina Fugazi called the shooting unacceptable during a news conference. This is Thanksgiving weekend. This is when families come together, celebrate, share memories, and give each other love, she said. Unfortunately, tonight, heaven is a little bigger with the individuals, children, and adults that unfortunately did not make it. Stockton Vice Mayor Jason Lee said he was in contact with staff and public safety officials to understand exactly what happened, and I will be pushing for answers. Tonight, my heart is heavy in a way that's hard to put into words, he wrote. As Vice Mayor of Stockton, and as someone who grew up in this community, I am devastated and angry to learn about the mass shooting at a child's birthday party. An ice cream shop should never be a place where families fear for their lives. Tropical storm death toll tops 600 in Southeast Asia. The death toll mounted to over 600 from floods and landslides caused by torrential rains across three countries in Southeast Asia, officials said on November 30th, as relief efforts for tens of thousands of displaced people continued over the weekend. Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand faced large-scale devastation after a rare tropical storm formed in the Malacca Strait, fueling heavy rains and wind gusts for a week. There were 435 dead in Indonesia, 170 in Thailand, and 3 deaths reported in Malaysia. Rescue and relief officials in the Southeast Asian countries were still trying to get access to many flood-hit areas on November 30th, even as floodwaters receded and tens of thousands of people were evacuated across the three countries. Over 4 million people have been affected, nearly 3 million in southern Thailand, and 1.1 million in western Indonesia, according to official statistics. Separately, across the Bay of Bengal, 153 people were killed by a cyclone in the island nation of Sri Lanka, authorities said, with 191 others missing and more than 500,000 affected nationwide. Indonesia. The death toll surged in Indonesia to 435 on November 30th, up from 303 on November 29th, official data uploaded on a government website showed, as officials compiled reports of casualties and damage pouring in from the western island of Sumatra, where three provinces had been devastated by landslides and floods after the rains. Many areas were cut off due to blocked roads, while damage to telecommunications infrastructure has hampered communications. Relief and rescue teams used helicopters to deliver aid to people in areas that could not be reached by road. from a Navy chopper flying over the isolated town of Palembayan in West Sumatra, a Reuters photographer saw large tracts of land and homes swept away by floodwaters. As the helicopter landed in a soccer field, dozens of people were already standing close by, waiting for food. There have been reports of people looting supply lines as they grow desperate for relief in other areas, officials said November 29th. According to official figures, 406 people were still reported missing and 213,000 displaced. Thailand and Malaysia. Thailand's Ministry of Public Health reported the death toll from flooding in southern Thailand at 170, an increase of 8 from November 29th, and 102 injuries. Songkhla province had the highest number of fatalities at 131. Hat Yai, the largest city in Songkhla, received 13 inches of rain November 21st, its highest single-day tally in 300 years, amid days of heavy downpours. In neighboring Malaysia, there are still about 18,700 people in evacuation centers, according to the country's National Disaster Management Agency. Meteorological authorities lifted tropical storm and continuous rain warnings on November 29th, forecasting clear skies for most of the country. Parts of the country were battered last week by heavy rain and wind. Malaysia's foreign ministry said it had evacuated over 6,200 Malaysian nationals stranded in Thailand. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Monday, December 1st issue of the Democrat and Chronicle. Your reader has been Jackie Cohen. Thank you for listening.